A week-long search in the Guinness Book of Records indicated to me that this was the first time in the history of the world that a Hanukkah menorah made the front pages of the Cleveland newspapers. Our resident evangelicals, the Chabadniks, persuaded our good mayor to allow the construction of a 13-foot-tall menorah on Public Square. And they even persuaded his honor to get into one of those hydraulic lift trucks, which are used to hoist a man up to change the lights in the street lights to kindle the first lamp of Chanukah. Now, that alone would not have made headlines. Our mayor has been known to do some strange things. What made the headline was the concern of various people in our federation that somehow the lighting of this menorah was in violation of the Constitution, the constitutional provisions dealing with the appropriate separation of state and church. And I think they're right. But I confess that I would have been far more impressed by the consistency and the cogency of their argument had they raised it in earlier years. Public square is public land, and religious symbols are obviously inappropriate for conspicuous display on those lands. At the same time, there's been a nativity scene on the public square for as long as I can remember. A grotto, the three wise men of the East, some animals looking balefully at the young Jesus. And not a word was spoken by those who defend our civil rights, which suggests to me that there was implicit in their concern not only the constitutional issue, but something of that old ghetto mentality that suggests that we have to be more circumspect than anyone else, and that certain violations of doctrine can be excused by the majority as long as they want it badly enough. In other words, it's a kind of double standard. What's good for them isn't necessarily good for us. Well, in any case, the great menorah controversy of 1976 will not go down into history, but it does give me an opportunity to raise with you the question that I'd like to deal with this morning, which is a question. Why, in fact, do we light the candles of a Hanukkah menorah? What's behind it? And when I raised this question informally some days ago, one of the younger members in the group looked at me rather tolerantly, and he said, "Well, Rabbi, everybody knows, even Christians." And I said to him, perhaps I'm getting old and I've accomplished my task as a rabbi and taught everybody everything about Judaism. I'm delighted if that's so. But why did you phrase it that way? Everybody knows, including Christians. And the answer was because Christians seem to know a lot about Hanukkah. They know the Hanukkah story. And as I thought about that answer, I became more and more convinced that he was, in fact, wiser than he was. Something out there in the non-Jewish world, in the Christian world, has raised Hanukkah in significance and turned Hanukkah into a major Jewish celebration, something it never was in all of its earlier history. I am convinced that it is the Christian world, the Christian environment in which we now live, which has turned Hanukkah into a Jewish high holiday. I think it's the only high holiday we owe to Christianity. But in any case, let's look at it. Let's look at this argument. In the medieval world, the world of our grandfathers, grandfathers, and grandmothers, Hanukkah had very little public significance. There was no synagogue liturgy for Hanukkah. The cheder did not dismiss for a midwinter Hanukkah vacation. There was no Hanukkah cantata in the ghetto or in the shtetl, and children did not receive presents on Hanukkah. Hanukkah was simply the lighting of a menorah during 8 days prescribed by the calendar in the home, and the reciting of an appropriate blessing, the blessing that was recited and sung by our high school today. Baruch Ata Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam She'asa Nisim Lavoteinu Bayamim Haheim Bazman Hazeh. We praise God for the miracles which he performed in those days and is continuing to perform in our day. Hanukkah bespoke the theme of God's redemption. But that was it. And if we look back for 1,000 years before the medieval world, during the time in which the Talmud was being written, the great Gaonic periods of our tradition, during the first millennium of this era, we find that Hanukkah was perhaps even less significant. One of the things that used to happen in the schools of Talmudic times was the fact that before each of the holidays, the master and his students would discuss the laws, the rules, the observances, the theology of the holiday. And the distillation of these discussions created the various tractates of the Talmud, which are devoted to each of the major celebrations of Jewish life. There's a tractate called Rosh Hashanah, for the new year. There's a tractate called Yoma, the day, which deals with Yom Kippur. There's a tractate Sukkot, Sukkot, and so on. There is no tractate Hanukkah. At no time in the ancient academies were the observances and the customs and the rituals of Hanukkah discussed. There are occasional, almost fugitive references to Hanukkah in the Talmud. As a matter of fact, we come upon a scene which is difficult to understand because it seems almost like kindergarten, and yet we know it took place in a graduate school where graduate students of Judaism were being taught by a senior professor. In the tractate called Shabbat, the laws concerning the Sabbath, we have a little vignette. One of these graduate students asks a question I would expect out of a first grader in the temple. My Hanukkah, why do we observe Hanukkah? And the answer that the senior gives is one which is the one that you know, that everyone knows, even Christians. And it has to do with the fact that in the second pre-Christian century, Palestine and most of West Asia were governed by an empire called the Seleucid Empire. It was one of those empires that were created by the generals of Alexander the Great after his premature death. Seleucus was one of his major commanders. And the fifth of the line had forged an empire which included much of what is today Lebanon, Syria, Israel, and Jordan. He was an ambitious man, Antiochus Epiphanes. And at one time, he attempted around the year 170, 169 before the Common Era to attack and conquer Egypt. And he was unsuccessful. The Roman legate intervened, forced him to retreat. Frustrated, embittered, and most of all fearful that the many city-states and small petty nations which comprised his empire would sense his weakness and begin to rebel, Antiochus ordered that loyalty oaths be taken in each of the city-states and in each of the small kingdoms. And the form of that ancient loyalty oath was to erect in the temple of the community, among the pantheon of the gods that were there, the patron god of Antiochus, of the whole empire, Zeus Olympius, and to offer an appropriate sacrifice to this god. Now, for most of the city-states, this was not difficult. Their pantheon included many gods. Why not add another? And if the emperor asked you to offer a sacrifice to his god, why not do it? But for our people, burdened by the second commandment, thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image, nor any manner of likeness of anything that is in the heavens above, or the earth beneath, or the waters under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down to them, nor serve them. To our people, this was an impossibility. And when they, by force, and through the agency of several quislings, this idol was in fact introduced into the temple, the idol of Zeus Olympios, the Jews became restive and rebellious, so much so that Antiochus felt that he had to proscribe the national cult of the Judeans, Judaism, and he did so. He prohibited the observance of the Sabbath. He prohibited the ritual act of circumcision. He prohibited the ordination of Jewish sages. And then there was rebellion. All of these, this prescription led to a national rebellion by the Judeans, led by a provincial priest by the name of Mattathias, who had five sons, whom we now call the Maccabees. And according to the conventional story, the story which is told in the Talmud and has been retold ever since, they fought first as guerrillas in the hills, and then after a number of victories and after large numbers of Judeans had flocked to the banner, the Maccabees felt strong enough to take to the field against the Syrian troops, and they defeated them in a number of battles, and ultimately they invested Jerusalem. They breached the walls, and they forced the Syrians and their quisling allies into the great impregnable fortress of Jerusalem, the Acre, as was told to us this morning. And they themselves recaptured the Temple Mount and set about immediately to reopen the sacrificial cult, desiring to dedicate immediately the altar so it could be in operation. They found themselves in a position where the altar and the great menorah, the great light of the temple, which required a specially clarified, ritually prepared kind of oil, that there was an insufficient supply of such oil. There was only enough oil for one day, and it takes 8 days, apparently, to prepare this oil in the priestly manner. Yet somehow, by a miracle, the one day's supply lasted for the 8 days, therefore the eight lights, therefore the menorah, and that is the nais, the miracle that was performed, the miracle which symbolizes the redemption, redemptive concerns of God with his people. That's the story. That's the story is told in the Talmud in this fashion. My Hanukkah, why do we observe Hanukkah? And the answer, the Greeks entered the temple. They defiled the oil therein, and when the Hasmoneans prevailed against them and defeated them, they searched and found a sole cruse of oil, which had been authorized by the seal of the high priest. It contained sufficient oil for one day's lighting only. Yet a miracle was wrought, and they lit the lamp, and it remained lit for the 8 days. So much for the lights of Hanukkah. That's the conventional explanation. That's the one we've all been taught, and it has only one trouble. It doesn't quite fit the historic facts. Let's look at this. The Talmud is an old book. The Talmud was edited in the 5th and 6th century of our era a long time ago, and it contains much earlier material. The paragraph which I read to you, it comes from a part of the Talmud or form in the Talmud known as the Braytot. These are writings which were set down in the 2nd and early 3rd century by Tanaim, the great Palestinian sages. So though it's a long time since this tradition was current in Judaism, we must also remember that 4 centuries passed between the revolt of the Maccabees and the setting down of this tradition. And the very fact that a graduate student in Judaism would ask his professor the simplistic question, why Hanukkah, suggests that a new theme is being introduced here, one which was not the conventional wisdom of their day, even as it is the current wisdom of ours. Now, when we look at the traditions about the Hasmonean, the Maccabean and Hasmonean victory, the purification and rededication of the temple in 164 before the Common Era, between that day and the Talmudic text, we find that over those 4 centuries, not a single text in our possession refers to the miracle of this cruse of oil and explains the menorah as a ritual which was reflective of what had happened in that great year of rededication, one which had been commanded by the Maccabees as an annual observance by Jews in their dwellings throughout their dispersion and in Jerusalem. What we find instead is that those who live near the time of this Baraita are unaware of the reasons for calling Hanukkah a feast of lights. The great Jewish historian of the first century, Josephus, describes the Maccabean revolt, describes the rededication of the temple, speaks of a Hanukkah, which he calls a feast of dedication and a feast of lights, but confesses that he does not know why it is called a feast of lights. And when we press back further, we find, interestingly, a document which was unknown to the rabbis of the Talmud because it had already been suppressed by their predecessors, a chronicle which was written by the Hasmoneans, the descendants of the Maccabees, who created a dynasty which ruled over Jerusalem and Judea for about 100 years after the great victory. They had written for them and about them a dynastic chronicle which is called the Book of the Maccabees, which now appears in a collection known as the Apocrypha, a Greek word which means the hidden books, books which were deliberately hidden away by Jews and not included in the Bible, suppressed by Jews. A document about a Jewish dynasty which ruled Judea, suppressed by the rabbis, which survives not because of Jewish interest, but because the church kept these documents for one reason or another. They were old and they had to do with Jews, the chosen people, before they became the chosen people. In this document, which is an authentic history of the time, written about a generation after the event, we find a very different explanation of Hanukkah, of its practice and its origin. According to the Book of Maccabees, when Judah and his troops invested Jerusalem in the late summer and early fall of 164 before the Common Era, they entered the temple. They found it desecrated, filthy, unused, and they went through what can only be called a funeral service. The original Hanukkah was not a festival of dedication so much as a funeral service. They felt that the altar had been desecrated, so one by one they took the stones of the holy altar and they buried them. And then they put on sackcloth and ashes, the garment of mourning in those days, and we're told that they sang kinot, lamentations, the eulogies, the funeral hymns of those days. They went through a funeral service for the sacredness of the temple that had been. They buried that. It had been defiled. And then they began to plan, how are we going to reconsecrate the sanctuary? And there was a priestly tradition that when the first temple had been consecrated by the prophet Samuel, he had ordered that there be a festival of dedication, a Hanukkah, which would last for 8 days, a time of the lighting of the great menorah of lights, a time of the singing of psalms and the offering of sacrifices. And there was also another priestly tradition that says that when King Hezekiah in the 8th pre-Christian century wanted to cleanse and purify the sanctuary from various chapels which had been put in there by queens of Judean kings, alien queens who had brought in their priests and their idols, he too had consulted a prophet, and the prophet had told him that a ceremony of dedication should last for 8 days, and he had celebrated with sacrifice and psalm a service of rededication for 8 days. The 8 lights represent the 8 days which ancient practice, ancient priestly practice, stipulate as a requirement of the ritual requirement for the dedication or rededication of a sanctuary. And so, having determined that the festival should last for 8 days, this great service of Hanukkah, of dedication, they try to determine the day on which it should take place. And they reminded themselves that 4 years before, on the 25th day of Kislev, the idol of Zeus Olympius, the hated idol, the abomination, had been raised. They decided to cancel that act by holding or beginning the great service of rededication on the very day, the very anniversary of the defilement 4 years before. So there was a good period of time between the conquest of the temple and the service of dedication. There was no reason that they couldn't have prepared whatever oil they required. There were priests in the Judean army. They had 3 or 4 months to make all the preparations. The myth or the miracle of the cruise of oil is patently that, a pious legend created much later in the second and third century of this era for reasons which I would like to suggest to you in a moment. The original Hanukkah was then a ceremony in the sanctuary, a great ceremony of thanksgiving and rededication, a ceremony which over the years, because it was celebrated annually, became a memorial of the freedom of the Judeans from the Syrians, and a great day in which the dynasty of Jews who descended from the Maccabees celebrated the ascension of their kings, the kings of their dynasty. It became their 4th of July. They had thrown off the yoke of the British, of the Syrians, and they had established their own rule. It was a great national holiday, a festival of independence. And it was celebrated only in the sanctuary, never in the home. And so it was celebrated for a century or more. And then times changed. The Roman rule began to spread throughout the Mediterranean basin. It was an iron-booted rule, cruel and stern and demanding and restrictive. And the Judean independence was lost. And there was heavy taxation, there was great cruelty, people became restive. And the young hotheads of the community reminded themselves of what these lights symbolized, how Judean soldiers had fought with courage and bravery against overwhelming odds and had begun victorious. Why can't we do it again? And out of the spirit of Hanukkah emerged that terrible revolt of 66-70, in which Jews fought against the Romans for 4 bloody years, and the Bar Kokhba revolt of 132-135, in which the Jews fought against the Romans for 4 more years. Matsada, which many of you have visited, is a testimony to the destruction which finally happened to them. It was bloody and it was brutal. 1 in 6 Jews, over 1 million Jews, were killed in the 4 years between 66 and 70 of this era. Another 1 million Jews were killed in the 3.5 years between 132 and 135 of our era. Jews who at that point, during those centuries, were at their greatest peak numerically in proportion to the rest of the world. We represented about 1 in 20 of all the citizens of the Eastern Roman Empire. We were strong, we had been independent, we felt power, Jewish power. Why not fight? And fight they did. And they were brutally suppressed and brutally put down. Now what happens to the 4th of July in a conquered country? What happens when the 4th of July must go underground? And when the young hotheads, having had their time and their second time and having fought against insuperable odds and having been defeated, when they continue to meet, continue to plan, continue to embolden one another with the ancient acts of derring do. Obviously, the wiser heads in the community will try and suppress the 4th of July. And interestingly, Hanukkah as we have it is a testimony not to the victory of the Maccabees so much as it is to the defeat of the Judeans, to the defeat of the Jews during these 2 terrible revolts against Rome. After the destruction of the temple in the year 70, one of the prices Jews had to pay for that defeat. The temple was plowed under, and the land of the Temple Mount was salted by the Romans. Nothing should ever grow there again. Nothing should ever be built there again. The Jews had to take the entire temple-centered cult and universalize it, diversify it, place it into the synagogue, and place it into the home. Now, they couldn't eradicate Hanukkah, but what they did was not to place it in the synagogue, where it might have been celebrated in very much the same way, but to take it out of the liturgy entirely and to place it into the home, and to take the lights and bring into the home a light which would be a reminder of the great menorah in the temple, but not be the same thing, 8 branches rather than 7. It fit the 8 days of the festival of rededication. And associate Hanukkah not with martial glory, not with the Maccabees. They suppressed the book of the Maccabees, but with God's miracle, the cruise of oil that lasts for 8 days. It is God who saves. She'asa nisim lavotenu bayamim haheim bazman hazeh. We don't read on Hanukkah, as we drew on Purim or at other times, a great scroll which tells of the victory of the Maccabees. That was never done. What we do is to speak of God's will to save his people, to save mankind, and we light these lights in memory and in anticipation of redemption. So Hanukkah, these lights are lit, is observed, and these lights are lit, not simply to celebrate the spirit of the Warsaw Ghetto, or of the pioneers and of the young soldiers who fought for Israel in 1948 and 1956 and 67 and 73. That's very much what we've turned Hanukkah into these days. It's the holiday which has become important to us because it bespeaks our desire to put behind us the patience, the passivity, the inaction of generations of Jews who were unwilling to rise up and to fight for their lives because they said God would save. And in any case, the powers out there were overwhelming. We've learned it's important to be an activist sometimes. It's important to take up arms sometimes. But if we look at Hanukkah for what it is historically, and recognize that Hanukkah, like all things that are wise and full of knowledge, full of insight, is a paradoxical holiday. We recognize that it suggests to us, that these lights suggest to us, that there is a time to be active and a time to be patient. That just as will and courage and sacrificial valor have their place, that is obviously part of what we celebrate this day. So patience and steadfastness and perseverance have their place in their time. That any virtue, whether it be activism or passivity, patience, must be carried out with understanding and in moderation. And as in all things, and at all times, there's a time for the Jew to take up arms, and there's a time for the Jew try to achieve what he can be achieved through diplomacy and understanding and statesmanship. These are the reasons then that we light these lights this day.